From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
It was literally a physical shock, the first time I've seen live a white man in blackface.
Blackface. It's now taboo, but there was a time when it was among the most popular forms of entertainment in America. We'll look at the cultural history of blackface today as we look at black identity. Also, the story of how America's press came to recognize the importance of the civil rights struggle.
And there in the spring of 1963, with the dogs on the loose and hoses being used on the protesters, you could not find a single image in the Birmingham News or the morning paper, the Post-Herald, of a dog or a hose unless it was Pet of the Week.
And we'll meet Pulitzer Prize-winning author Edward P. Jones.
Just what kind of black people who today would own slaves if it were legal? You have these singers, these rap stars, sports players, and they have no consciousness whatsoever. And I figured those are the kind of people who would own slaves if they could and never once think about the fact that their ancestors had once been slaves.
And we'll look at the new wave of black cinema. But first, black men are in crisis, and it may be that the long-standing ideal of the strong black man is at the heart of the problem that black men face today. That's the argument that cultural critic Mark Anthony Neal puts forward in his book New Black Man. As he told Steve Paulson, Neal proposes a new model of black masculinity, the new black man.
Much of the book is, in fact, a tribute to Masani Alexis DeVoe, who is my intellectual mentor. She teaches women's studies at the University of Buffalo now. And she, in fact, gave me the name of New Black Man because she thought there was something about the way that I processed issues of gender and sexuality, the way that I wrote, that she found something remarkable. You know, she described me as this black feminist male. And she hadn't seen a whole lot of those. And indeed, it's not like, you know, the world is overrunning with black male feminists. You know, but part of the rationale there was that, you know, can we rethink and imagine what a masculinity, black masculinity could look like if it was anti-homophobic, if it was pro-feminist, if it was nurturing, right? And that, and it's not that, you know, the idea of a strong black man, that there's anything wrong with that, but can we move beyond that particular trope and get to a position where at least we can create a model where black men and young black boys in particular are simply comfortable in the skin that they're in and don't feel the need to have to play a certain kind of performance that lives up to some sort of notion of a strong, hard, resolute black masculinity.
Now, it sounds like this is the same debate that's been playing out for years among white men as well. Are there different issues that come into play for black men in particular?
The difference between the conversations that we're seeing, you know, amongst white men, when I think about some of the men who are doing incredible work, Jackson Katz, you know, is someone who comes to mind immediately in terms of a white male who's done incredible work around this kind of issue. I think what's different in, the work of, say, a Jackson Katz or the issues that face white men versus black men is that in the case of black men, you're dealing with a historic demonization of black masculinity. And in part, you know, even as we're trying to hold black men accountable, particularly around issues of domestic violence and sexual violence and rape, there is a reality that, you know, in the mindset, in the American psyche, you know, black men are the quintessential rapist. You know, many of the lynchings that we saw in the 19th and early 20th century have so much to do with this idea that there was some black man who was after some white woman sexually and it had to be punished for it. So I think because there's been this long history of the demonization of black masculinity, I think the issues around recovering a more progressive notion of masculinity are different than they are for white men.
Well, you quote the art critic Thelma Golden, who said, "One of the greatest inventions of the 20th century is the African-American male, invented because black masculinity represents an amalgam of fears and projections in the American psyche."
Yeah, I mean, there are an incredible amount of meanings attached to black male bodies. And in some ways, I'm complicating this by just attaching more, you know, more ideals and labels on top of black male bodies. But I think, you know, what I'm really trying to do is that can we think about an ideal or a model of black masculinity that's not legible to the mainstream, right? There's so many examples of ways that black men are made legible. When they're presented as pimps, when they're presented as thieves, when they're presented as rappers or ball players. I mean, those are the easy associations we make when we see images of black male bodies. I want to push the boundaries and expand what we think of as black masculinity and talk about the ways in which black masculinity currently may not be as legible, right? But to get young black men thinking about the possibility that, yes, you can think of yourself as pro-feminist. You can think of yourself as a nurturing father, you can think of yourself of not having to live up to some sort of stereotype and myth about some incredible black masculinity and black sexuality. I mean, when you think about all of the stereotypes about, you know, how black men are endowed and black male sexuality, I mean, those are simply tropes and myths that black men, on the one hand, have tried to distance themselves from, but at the same time have found incredibly enticing in terms of embracing this idea that black men are so powerful and sexually virile. It's almost a catch-22 situation.
But I would guess one response you'd get is that black men already are one down coming into the conversation, you know, just entering mainstream life in America. And maybe you need that swagger. Maybe you need to project that toughness, that authority to be able to compete in the society.
And I could accept that critique. And indeed, when I think about my own life as a young man, and even today, you know, one of my symbolic role models these days is a figure like Jay-Z. And part of it is just the swagger of the man that I can appreciate. It comes through in his image and comes through in his music. And I can appreciate that, you know, in terms of black men, this whole idea of a cool pose that Richard Majors talked about so many years ago. While I understand the value of that, at the same time, I don't want to create a context in which black men and black boys are locked into a notion that that's the only way they can perform their masculinity. And the reality is that, you know, very often within black institutions and black communities, you know, if you're a black man or a young black boy who doesn't fit into this very rigid notion of black masculinity, you're seen as suspect, right? You're not black enough, you're not male enough, you're not black male enough. And it raises all kinds of questions, and a whole host of other meanings get attached to you. So, you know, the fact that when we deal with issues of homophobia within the black community, when we deal with issues of black men who are suspected of being gay and lesbian, I mean, the best example is the whole, you know, DL phenomenon within the black community now, where you have, you know, a significant number of black men who are married, traditional heterosexual relationships, who choose to engage in unsafe sexual practices with men. And, you know, while they need to be held accountable for that, the reality is that part of the reason why they're on the DL or on the down low is because there really isn't a space within black communities and institutions for them to safely come out and acknowledge the complexity of their sexuality.
So you're saying that's truer in among black men. I mean, there's more of a stigma for black men to come out and say they're gay than for white men.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that. What I think is that, you know, we don't necessarily demonize white men the same way. And I'm not saying that homophobia doesn't exist, right? I mean, homophobia is a very real thing. But I'm not sure we attach as much meaning to white men who will come out and happen to be homosexuals as we do in the case of black men within the black community, because of this whole idea that just historically black men are under siege. And very often the way homosexuality has been interpreted among many blacks and within many black institutions is that it is the byproduct of the white supremacist reality that black men have to face with. So, you know, it becomes a marker of white folks and white power have done to black folks that you would have gay men. And I'm not sure that same kind of logic, you know, works the same way within the context of white men who may be homosexuals.
Now, at the end of your book, you talk about the new black man as really a metaphor for an imagined life. Can you explain this metaphor?
I mean, part of it is that as the author of the book, I didn't want people to read the book, particularly because so much of it is autobiographical. I didn't want folks to read the book as me saying, I'm the new black man, follow me. I really wanted to put it out there as this kind of ideal, as something that's imagined, that I have been on now a 41-year struggle to achieve and have not achieved yet. And I think I wanted to put it out there as an ideal because I'm not saying that there's a perfect model of what this is. And that for every black man and for every young black boy, you know, this new black manhood is going to manifest itself in different ways because we're all facing all kinds of different personal challenges and personal demons. So I didn't want to put out a blueprint that said that if you do this, this, and that, you're a new black man, right? So I wanted to give young black men, in particular, the creative license to imagine a black masculinity that was different than the one that we have been sold for so many years.
Mark Anthony Neal is the author of New Black Man. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Think that blackface doesn't exist anymore in these culturally sensitive times? Well, it's certainly not as prevalent as it once was. But a man named Chuck Nipp performs in blackface. He puts greasy chocolate brown makeup on his face, neck, and hands, and wears a bad pink wig and a house dress. and performs as a black woman named Shirley Q. Licker.
How you doing? This here is Shirley Q, honey. Ooh, I'm so aggravated. You know, I just got back from Kmart. I had to run down there and get me some toilet paper. And, you know, we go through a 9-roll a day over here with 19 kids. Good life. Plus company. Shoes. I had to get me some toilet paper. I was all out of Pepsi Cola. I had to get me some spray for my house for them roaches they got crawling up in there.
John Strasbaugh is the author of Black Like You, Blackface, Whiteface, Insult, and Imitation in American Popular Culture. He saw Shirley Q. Licker on stage at a club in New York City in February 2004.
It was the strangest experience when he first came out as he does another character named Betty Butterfield, and she's a white woman, sort of a white trash character. And that was one thing, and everybody laughed along. Then he came out in blackface, and it was literally a physical shock the first time you saw a white, I mean, first time I've seen live a white man in blackface. I mean, the person standing next to me said he felt sick to his stomach at first, because it's just such a shock. And then as the routine continued, some of it you found yourself laughing because it is funny, but you're really upset with yourself for standing there laughing. So it raises, your head is spinning by the time you leave the room, and it has raised a lot of ideas and a lot of issues for you, which I think, you know, in many ways is what comedy is for.
Well, even going into that club, though, I gather, you had to go through a line of people protesting the fact that this performance was going to take place.
Yeah. In fact, he rarely gets to perform because people start protesting in advance, and then club owners probably wisely end up saying, you know what, let's just cancel the event. This one, it was a relatively small crowd of kids, but you did have to sort of run the gauntlet. I'm not sure. I think for a lot of people, that just kind of added to the, you know, the frisson of the evening. It just made it more exciting for them, I think.
Yeah. So when blackface was popular back in the 1850s, when minstrel shows were up, who was going to those shows? Who was the audience?
When they first started, they start on the Bowery in New York City. I mean, when they first start becoming really popular. And that's young, mostly Irish, very poor white guys going to see it and doing the performing. The first couple of superstars were young Irish Americans from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And they were in a very special situation socially because they were, in many places, considered lower than black folks. They were at least as low as black folks. They were looking to distinguish themselves from black folks and say, no, we are white folks. And one of the ways of doing that was, oddly, to put on the blackface and imitate black folks. They were saying by being able to make fun of black folks, they were saying we're not black, we're white, because only white folks can make fun of black folks this way. But it was even more complicated than that for them, though, because they were also, you can hear it in the lyrics, you can hear it in the songs. They were not just making fun, and it was not just an insult. There was something about black culture as they understood it that they liked, that they appreciated, that they wanted to imitate the same way, you know, rock and rollers 150 years later imitate black music. They're not doing it to make fun of black folks. They actually like it, and it's, you know, the sincerest form of flattery sort of imitation. There was an element of that in the earliest years of blackface in the 1820s and 1830s, and I think that's been forgotten now, and of course it has. It was a long, long time ago, but you can hear it in the music.
Well, things have changed. It's not acceptable anymore, except that, as you say, it is sort of acceptable today. What is blackface doing today?
Yeah, I don't know that it's acceptable, but it's still around in various. One of the things that happens with hugely popular elements of pop culture, as blackface was, it's hard to kill them. They don't die so much as mutate, and they come back in different forms and in different ways. There are a whole lot of music critics and social critics who see a lot of elements of blackface in hip-hop and rap videos.
You're going to have to explain that to me. I don't understand.
The degrading, stereotyped images of the black male as a thug, as oversexed, as wearing tons and tons of bling is very much a late 20th century, early, or this is the argument at any rate, and I think I agree with it, very much a late 20th century, early 21st century version of the same sort of stereotyped images that were strutting on the minstrel stage 120 years ago. And the fact that there are black performers doing it is not very different either, because there were many black performers doing it on the minstrel stage.
Now, you also write about the fact that there has been a flip of this. There's a history of blacks using whiteface to satirize whites. Now, I'm not sure it's the same thing.
It's not the same thing, but it's interesting that it goes back just as far. And it goes back to white folks and black folks first encountering one another and instantly noticing the differences and instantly starting to make fun of the differences. So in West Africa, even at the time when the first white slavers were showing up, black folks were making fun of the way white people walk, the way they smell. They were completely appalled by the way white folks smelled. Their hair, they couldn't stand the straight hair, and et cetera, et cetera. They brought those traditions with them when they were brought here. And very early on, there are festivals that are kind of like primitive versions of Mardi Gras, where they would do processions wearing whiteface, dressed up as white people, and walking in a very stiff, white person sort of way, which became, years later, the famous dance, the cakewalk. And then white people wanted to learn how to do the cakewalk because they thought it was, you know, it was hip in the 1890s. So you have all these white folks learning how to do a dance that black folks originally did to make fun of white folks.
So let me ask you, is it acceptable for you to write about blackface? You're a white guy.
Yeah, I know. And I did get a review in the Los Angeles Times. The first line of the review was, "Who does John Strasbaugh think he is?" And the second line was, "No, I'm serious. Who does John Strasbaugh think he is?" She was very upset that a white man decided to write about this history. But, you know, I consider myself an American. It's American history. It's a behavior that white people started. And so who better to write about it than a white person? I even have a lot of Irish in me, so I even get to say that. I mean, if we're going to start parsing out American history to who gets to write about it and who doesn't, which has been a tradition in academia over the last 20, 30 years, then no, I shouldn't have written this book. But since I don't believe any of that, I think history is there for all of us to study and try to learn from and scratch our heads over and write about. If you're going to be upset that I wrote the book, be upset. I can't stop you, but I think it's foolish.
So what does all this tell us about American culture? I mean, what is the history of, that's a big question. Yeah. But what is the history of blackface tell us, do you think, about American culture?
There is one, and I probably get in trouble for saying this as well, but there is one kind of positive thing that comes out of it, which is that it's a reminder that we're a mongrel culture. We're a mutt culture. We're not even multi-culti. We're not a rainbow. We're more like a muddy mix of everything. And we have been from day zero. That is America. And everybody in the rest of the world seems to understand that better than Americans sometimes. We're not white. We're not black. We're not Asian. We're all of that put together. And we spend a lot of time, and we especially spent a lot of time 100 years ago, 150 years ago, looking at one another, making fun of one another, being upset to have to spend time with one another, but learning how to tolerate one another one way or another. And I think popular culture is an arena where those issues get played out. Instead of beating each other up on the street all the time, sometimes we're just hitting each other over the heads with toy hammers on stage and making fun of one another on stage. And at some point, we get used to each other that way. A lot of people don't buy that argument, but I do believe it.
John Strasbaugh, he's the author of Black Like You, Blackface, Whiteface, Insult and Imitation in American Popular Culture. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll explore the dense fictional world of award-winning writer Edward P. Jones, and we'll find out how the press turned the civil rights struggle into the most important domestic news event of the 20th century as we continue our hour on Black Identity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Edward P. Jones won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award for his debut novel, The Known World. He received a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2004. Jones has a new collection of short stories called All Aunt Hagar's Children. Edward P. Jones told Steve Paulson where the title comes from.
I didn't choose it from the Bible. Beggar's children is a phrase my mother used for black people. So that was it. That was the beginning of it. I never thought actually about Hagar in the Bible. I haven't read Uncle Tom's Cabin, but apparently there's a slave in her named Hagar. I didn't know about that. I knew, of course, about the biblical story, but that wasn't my reference point. It was simply because of what my mother had said all the time. And it was a phrase, all of Hagar's children, that encompassed, I think, almost all the characters in the book. And also, I think it was also a nod to a book that I read in my teens and that I was very much impressed with, which is Richard Wright's collection of stories called Uncle Tom's Children.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the biblical story, it was Hagar was the woman who bore a child
by Abraham,
yeah. Because his wife couldn't have right. children. And then Hagar was pushed out.
By Sarah, yes.
Yeah. And so you can clearly see the resonances
right.
then
yes.
with
yeah.
the history of black
right.
Americans.
Exactly, yes.
Now, it would seem that dislocation is a theme that runs throughout these stories. Many of the people, many of the characters in your stories have moved from the South or trying to establish themselves in Washington, D.C., and some do, and some have a harder time making a go of it there. Tell me your thinking there. How does Washington sort of figure into your fictional imagination?
Well, it doesn't in any spectacular way, I have to say. It's a place where I was born and raised, so I know it. I know it better than any other city. And being that I'm a writer and I have characters, I would want to situate them in the place where I know the streets and everything. And that's just it, exactly. I mean, had I been born in any other town or city in this country, then perhaps those places would have been the background for it.
Let's talk about some of the stories. The first one is called In the Blink of God's Eye. How would you describe that story?
It takes place in 1901, and it follows a young couple's journey from Arlington, Virginia, just across the river from Washington, to lives in Washington, D.C., and the wife, one night, unable to sleep, standing on the porch and happens to see a bundle hanging from an apple tree, and after her initial fear, she goes to the bundle and finds it's a baby, and the story proceeds from there about the effect the baby has on this married couple's life, their lives.
No one ever came to claim the baby, and before long, Aubrey, no longer blessed with guiltless sleep because of the baby crying in the night, went the other way when he heard Ruth approaching those quiet corners. He began to devote even more time to trying to find who might have lost a baby boy. By February, he was even knocking on the back doors of white people to find out, as he put it, if they had heard tell of someone who was in the family way and now was not, but had no baby to show for it. By February, too, he was resenting Ruth for having so easily made a home for the baby with them in that big front room. From that first night, she had put the baby in the wooden crib one of her older brothers had created, a small thing of absolute beauty, with cherubs carved on the sides, cherubs doing everything from throwing balls to jumping rope to sitting on tree limbs. A cherub with closed eyes and upraised arms and wings unfurled sat with his fat crossed ankles on the crib's headboard. The crib had always been intended for their own first child, but now, day after day, Aubrey could see the orphan sleeping in it, his arms spread without a care in the world, his belly fat with milk Aubrey himself had taken from the humpback cow Joan rented to make the butter she sold.
And then the husband feels kind of pushed out when the baby enters into the family.
Yeah, she realizes, of course, that the baby is an orphan, and she has to become the mother. She doesn't say it exactly, but I think she had hoped that the father would follow her.
There's another one of your stories called The Root Worker, which gets at this tension between modern life in Washington and the old traditions back in, I think, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that story.
I wish I was able to take notes when the ideas first come to me, but if I had known people would be interested, I certainly would have taken notes, but I didn't have any idea anyone would be interested. I think I was just fascinated by the idea of a woodworker, a voodoo person in the South, encountering someone whose whole life has been science. The story is about a doctor, a woman in Washington, D.C., and her mother has been suffering mental illness for a long time. And the story begins when the father has heard about a root worker in North Carolina, where they came from, and decides that he wants to take his wife to this woman. The daughter, the doctor, is quite reluctant, of course, given that, as I said, science is the center of her life.
She's scornful of the whole notion of those kind of old folk remedies.
Yeah, and I think that she's just, her idea is that maybe, her mother's been taking medicine for all this time, but her thinking probably is that, well, there's a cure for her for all this sadness that she has, all the problems she has. There's a cure just around the corner. But the father, I think, is open to this idea. And I think that's the notion that I often thought about a lot of times, this thing of the old and the new. And the fact that some of the people who deal with the new have to realize that maybe the new isn't necessarily the best thing.
You mean voodoo? Glynis said. Some call it that. But when I was coming up in North Carolina, they was roots done by a root worker. He knew well he was speaking to a woman who put her faith in science. I know, she had thought as she watched him read the medicine labels. I know science has failed us. Morton now stood and placed both dessert dishes and forks into the sink and began washing them. He and the dishwashing machine did not get along. He knew well to whom he was speaking about root workers, because that was how he had steered her life, education. Once they turn the lights on in your head, they can't turn them off.
Well, tell me what happens then when they actually go back to North Carolina and the mother then encounters this root worker.
The mother's mental illness is illustrated by the fact that there's a phenomenon called witch's riding. And she can be asleep, and there is this paralysis that comes over her. And I pictured this with three witches who come into even a locked room and sit on her and paralyze her. And she has to struggle and struggle to wake up and get out of that. Once they get to North Carolina, this root worker has some simple leaves. She has gardens in the back in front of her house, and there are all a number of different plants that she has. And one of those, almost overnight, cures Glennis's mother of this ailment. And gradually, over the course of several weeks, Glennis, the doctor, sees that science and modern medicine isn't the cure-all for everyone. So it's a gradual realization on her part that maybe this old woman who's cross-eyed, thick glasses, very old, and who is not even knowing enough to know how our television operates, that maybe, just maybe, she has perhaps even more to teach her than all the professors in medical school.
He wrote an essay called We Tell Stories.
That essay has been following me forever. It seems as if a million people have read that. I am absolutely amazed at how many people have read that. I wrote it for a bookstore in Oregon, and it seems to have gone around the world.
Are you tired of talking
no,
about it?
No, I'm not. I'm just amazed at, you know, a few words that so many people have read them.
Well, if you bear with me.
Please.
Well, partly because, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are intrigued because in that essay you talk about why you write and sort of what propelled you to start writing. And one thing that you said was that you'd never thought about writing a novel when you were in college, but there was something else that happened later on or something that you noticed. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I learned as far as a novel that there have been black people who owned slaves. That's what the novel is about, essentially. And it was after I finished the first book and was thinking about what I would do next that I thought about that one fact and began to craft a novel around that. But the essay is about the fact that there are those writers, and I never believe that I'm one of them, who write because they want to be rich and famous, and there are those of us who write because we cannot help ourselves. We are compelled to. Most of the known world, the novel took about 11 and a half years to write, but as I tell people, and that's something that I discovered after the book was finished, is that writing isn't all about the physical act of typing on the keys. It's also what I did for 10 years, which was to think about this book in my head and work it all out.
You thought about it for 10 years before you started writing anything?
Yeah, in a very general way, it was all worked out. A few lines I had that were exact, you know, detailed, starting with the first line, and I knew what that would be, and I knew exactly what the last line would be.
But you weren't writing out outlines or anything like
that? No, no outlines whatsoever, no notes. But I did, and I think this is because the world in my head is one thing, but at times I think I wanted to see what it looked like on a page. And sometime in the 1990s, because I started thinking about it in 1992, and had the first draft finished in March of 2002. So at one point, I typed out what was in my head, the first 6 pages of the first chapter and the first 6 pages of the final chapter, because I just wanted to see what it looked like. You know, I could not sit down and really read and touch the way I could something that was on the computer screen. But those 12 pages are the only thing that anyone could hold in her hands and say, yeah, this is tangible here. Everything else was in my head.
What made you want to write about that subject, the historical fact that there were black slave owners?
Yeah, I didn't have any agenda or any issues or anything. What happens often is, if there is an issue, it's below the surface. It's, for me, it's always about character and characters. So I think once I remembered this thing about black slave owners, gradually, I think the first image, and I believe this is the first image that came to me about the novel, was this man, Henry Townsend, 31, a black slave owner, who is dying in one of his rooms in this nice house, and in that room are 3 women. Then I had to create a world before he got to that bed and create the world that went on after he died.
And I'm assuming the whole ethical quandary, mm-hmm. I mean, the premise of a black slave, I mean, that was that the thing that you wanted to explore?
I think so. I think it's, you know, especially with, I lived through the 1980s and then early 90s, and I was seeing a lot of things where I looked around the political and social landscape and asked myself just what kind of people, black people, who today would own slaves if it were legal. You have, you know, these singers, these rap stars, sports players, and they have no consciousness whatsoever. Some political people have no consciousness whatsoever. And I figured those are the kind of people who would own slaves if they could, and never once think about the fact that their ancestors had once been slaves.
Edward P. Jones is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Known World and the new short story collection All Aunt Hager's Children. He spoke with Steve Paulson. The readings were performed by Peter Francis James and are from the audiobook version of All Aunt Hager's Children. Hank Klibanoff is the managing editor for News at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's also the co-author, along with Gene Roberts, of a book called The Race Beat: The Press, the Civil Rights Struggle, and the Awakening of a Nation. As Klibanoff and Roberts write in the book, the nation's press ignored the civil rights struggle for decades. Hank Klibanoff told Ann Strangchamps about the first civil rights story that made a lot of headlines in the mainstream media.
The Emmett Till trial, certainly in the late summer, early fall of 1955, would not have necessarily been called a civil rights story at the time. It was just a horrific crime against a 14-year-old black kid who came down to the Delta of Mississippi from Chicago. But it certainly drew major national attention. It drew a lot of reporters from Chicago, from New York, from the wire services, from television. And it also, for the first time, lent some odd and dignity to the black reporters who were there, because the judge agreed to let them have a table inside the courtroom not far from where he sat and from where the witnesses sat. And so for the first time in a significant way, you had a cadre of white reporters from across the nation sitting in the same courtroom and basically at the same level and status as black reporters from across the nation, covering a story of this great atrocity that was racial in nature.
Now, I imagine for Southern readers, this was one more racial killing in a long history of them. But in many ways, this would have been the first for Northern newspaper readers, right?
It was certainly the most pronounced that came to their attention. The fact is that in that same year, 1955, 2 significant black leaders for voting rights and for human rights in the Mississippi Delta were both killed. And while, again, it got great coverage in the black press, no one else really paid much attention to it. But Emmett Till, the idea that it was a 14-year-old, I think, was just too provocative for the nation to ignore and for its press to ignore.
What happened when Till's murderers were acquitted? How was that covered in the press?
Well, no one expected otherwise. When the jury returned, as the Race Beat points out, the jurors took, I think, almost an hour to return their verdict. But what they said was it wouldn't have taken that long except they stopped to have a soda. No one expected otherwise. It was standard fare for acquittals to come in cases like this. But what did happen in the Emmett Till case, one of the more remarkable reporters of the last century, William Bradford Huey, an Alabamian, he came into town. He was just freelancing, and he got to know the lawyers for the two men who were accused of killing Till, J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant. And he drank a lot with them, and he sort of figured out that the two lawyers had no loyalty whatsoever to Milam and Bryant. They thought they were, in their own words, a bunch of peckerwoods, who rednecks, who were ultimately going to give the South a bad name if they weren't controlled. They agreed to a deal with William Bradford Huey in which he would pay money for Milam and Bryant and Carolyn Bryant, the wife of one of them, the woman who Till allegedly wolf-whistled, to tell the story of what happened and how they killed Emmett Till. And they agreed to it, and they took the money, and they told their story, and it was published. And even though there were some people who initially challenged it, it ultimately has been proven right and has stood the test of time.
That's an extraordinary story. Well, what effect did Huey's story have when it was published? Were the suspects retried?
No, there was no retrying them, and it may have been pointless, too. The agreement he had prohibited him from writing specifically that they had confessed. All he could do was render this very powerful narrative of how they did it without actually saying, and this is the story they have told me. Mm-hmm. So early on, some of the segregationist editors in the South, and a particular segregationist columnist named John Temple Graves, just accused Huey of making it all up, of lying. And Huey was kind of in a box. He didn't know how to prove otherwise. But somehow, and I think it was through an intermediary, an attorney who sort of lived in the two worlds of segregation and progressive thought, was able to prove to John Temple Graves and to other editors in the South that Huey had, in fact, interviewed these people. And Huey demanded and got from this Graves an apology, and ultimately quite a few newspapers in the South that had run the John Temple Graves column accusing Huey of being a liar had to run apologies for that.
What kind of impact do you think Huey's story had on the general media coverage of civil rights issues? I'm wondering whether, in particular, whether Huey's story partly began to convince other reporters and other editors to kind of tell the truth about the real violence that was being perpetrated against blacks in the South.
Now, that's a very good question. I think it's inevitable that that's true, that the lesson from William Bradford Huey on this and on other stories that he did, because he was a remarkable man, the lesson was that if you dig deep enough and if you keep going, there is a truth to be found. And he liked to say, I'm in the truth-telling business. And while your average daily reporter, you know, for a wire service churning out the stories doesn't necessarily have time to go back in and do the kind of work that Huey did, it certainly led people to daily reporters to understand that there is always going to be a story behind the story. And it's not that anyone doubted that Milam and Bryant did it. They only doubted whether they could ever get them to acknowledge that they did it or get a jury to believe that they did it or get a jury to convict them. And I think it probably was a great lesson for other reporters.
At what point did the mainstream press begin to kind of take the gloves off and begin reporting really openly and frankly about the kind of violence they were seeing in the streets during civil rights protests?
2 years after Emmett Till, you have this extraordinary situation that develops in Little Rock, Arkansas. Little Rock was a very progressive town. They had a progressive governor, Orville Faubus, who had been promoted and supported by the editor of the Arkansas Gazette, which itself was progressive. Arkansas, not unlike several border states abutting the South, were moving forward on integration issues. But at the last minute, segregationist forces came down on Orville Faubus. They cornered him. They made him re-examine his progressive thinking. And then on the eve of school integration at Central High School in Little Rock, he changed his mind. And instead, he called out the National Guard to as he said, to keep the peace, but in fact it was to keep the 9 black students there out. Up until that point, I think you could say that the mainstream media, not unlike Johnny Popham, the New York Times reporter, was having a hard time believing how extreme attitudes were. By that point, the Montgomery bus boycott had taken place and the newspapers had been slow to get down there and to really believe, no one believed that the boycotters would keep that boycott going as long as they did. So I think there was a growing respect for and belief in the tenacity of the movement that was emerging.
You came of age during the events we've been talking about, so you lived this history, and yet here you've gone back to look over it all again. Has researching and writing this book changed the way you think about the civil rights movement?
Well, that's a very good question. I can't say that it has changed what I have thought, but it has certainly given it greater depth. I grew up in Alabama. I was born in 49, so when Brown versus Board came down, I was just getting ready to enter elementary school. By the time I'm 14, I have a paper route. I live in North Alabama. I'm delivering the Birmingham News, the afternoon paper after school. And every day I'd sit there and look at the front page of the paper as I'm rolling up the papers and putting the rubber bands on it. And the Birmingham News would not have a single story on its front page about the civil rights struggle. And there in the spring of 1963, with the dogs on the loose and hoses being used on the protesters, you could not find in the Birmingham News, and I've gone back to double check, a single image in the Birmingham News or the morning paper, the Post Herald, of a dog or a hose unless it was Pet of the Week. And they made a decision that they were going to keep the story of civil rights on pages 2 and 3 and that they were not going to put these images that were the most provocative out there. And yet my hometown paper in Florence, Alabama, was putting it out on page 1, and the national news had it every night. And, you know, this is when everyone gathered to watch national news. So there was this real disconnect that I never really was able to sort through until I began to research this and, one, find that my memory was correct, but, two, what the motives were behind it. And it wasn't just bad news judgment. It was a politicized judgment that I think had a very deleterious effect as far as informing the readers of the Birmingham papers.
Hank Klibanoff. He's the co-author, along with Gene Roberts, of The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation. He spoke with Ann Strainchamps. Coming up, we'll find out how black cinema has changed in the last 20 years as we conclude our Hour on Black Identity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Esther Averim is a former reporter for the New York Times. She's also reviewed film for the Washington Post and New York Newsday. Averim is the author of We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006. The book chronicles the new wave in black film that began 20 years ago with the Spike Lee film She's Gotta Have It. Esther Averim talks about the first time she saw She's Gotta Have It when it was released in 1986.
So I went to a matinee, I believe, and when the movie began, I just realized it was something very different. It was in black and white, you know, it didn't come on with the big kind of, you know, action scenes from a blaxploitation flick or anything like that. It wasn't like, you know, Eddie Murphy in Beverly Hills Cop, you know. It was an art film. And that was something very different for me to see in terms of the subject matter dealing with, like, my generation, you know, then 20-something, you know, African-Americans.
In my experiences, I found two types of men, the decent ones and the dogs. It seems that men are taught not to be in touch with themselves, with their true feelings, but the things that they do say, weak.
You so fine, baby. I drink a tub of your bath water.
I just want to rock your world.
Baby, it's got to be you and me.
You may not realize it tonight, but you're sending out some very strong vibes. May I continue?
And then when I really got into the story and I really realized what it was about, I also realized that the subject matter was very different because it was dealing with this young woman, Nola Darling, and her relationships with three boyfriends. And right. I had never really seen, well, first of all, it was kind of, you know, very daring at that time to really kind of talk about having, like, you know, three boyfriends. But also, you know, it was very daring to kind of deal with, you know, love, black love and sexuality in an artistic way. It wasn't in an exploitative way. Nola Darling wasn't a hooker. She didn't have a rabbit fur jacket and a, you know, crazy platform shoes standing on the corner, which is, you know, the image that I would see more often of black women in film. So yeah. it was very different for me. It was, you know, and they dealt with her body as a beautiful object, you know what I mean? It was kind of rendered artfully in terms of the lighting, and you know, you could, you know, I had never seen a film that really kind of showed right. even black bodies or black sexuality in a really beautiful way.
This is a whole new thing then, wasn't it? I mean, it's hard to remember in a way because it's 20 years ago now, but your expectations even going in to see this as a person who has seen a lot of movies, it was still a surprise for you to see what Spike Lee did to change the art form.
Yes, yes. And I realize now, you know, knowing more about film, that he wasn't necessarily changing the art form, but he was changing the subject matter, or he was allowing African Americans or black people to be a part of an art form that was ongoing instead of just kind of a Hollywood boilerplate rendering of black life.
You write in the book, anyway, that this, you think, marked the beginning of a new wave in black film. Now, I don't know whether Spike Lee knew what he was starting then, but it's clear that the whole idea of African Americans in film took on a different aspect after that, and other people got chances maybe that they wouldn't have had before, right?
I think so. Along with him at that time, you had Robert Townsend coming out the next year with Hollywood Shuffle, and he and Keenan Ivory Wayans put together a comedy, which was really also the first comedy that I really thought was, like, written for me.
Let's talk to a graduate. This is Ricky Taylor. Ricky graduated from our class 3 years ago. Ricky, can you tell us what you've been doing since you've graduated?
Well, Robert, I've played 9 crooks, 4 gang leaders, 2 dope dealers. I played a rapist twice.
Whoa.
That was fun.
I'm so happy for you. Need I say any more? It's Hollywood's first black acting school. It teaches you everything.
Classes are enrolling now. Learn to play TV pimps, movie muggers, street punks. Courses include Jive Talk 101, Shuffling 200, Epic Slaves 400, Dial 1-800-555-COON.
There's a whole different culture going on, and I think maybe that's what you're talking about, that a white person going to a movie that stars white people sees things going on that are familiar. But
right.
you going to that same movie, you'd recognize all those things and maybe see why a white person would find it funny, but it wouldn't hit it for you?
Not necessarily. I mean, I could because, you know, we live with what Du Bois called a double consciousness, and we live in two worlds, and so many of us are kind of bicultural and bilingual, not gone to graduate school, and, you know, I had gone to fine schools, and I knew how to conduct myself in, you know,
sure.
and I knew much of the culture that wasn't necessarily mine, and so I could enjoy movies, but what I thought was different was that in these new movies coming out was that the culture from the other part of my life, you know, the culture I grew up with in my parents' home or that I experienced with my friends as a teenager or as a young person, kind of like inside jokes, you know, were suddenly like on the screen.
Do you see any shortcomings in the new wave of black film?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. I think I mentioned some of them in the introduction of the book. And number one, you know, it's been far too much a male new wave of film. When you look at the directors, producers, writers, people who have
right. When you mention Spike Lee and John Singleton and
Right. That not only in terms of the opportunities, but in terms of the voices. I mean, if you look at the stars and the subject matter of most of the movies, you know, it revolves around men. You know, we had that whole period of kind of very, you know, kind of ghetto-centric, you know, very violent hood films. And that usually involves some kind of drug dealer or some kind of young criminal element. And it was all very male. It was usually told from a very male point of view. And I'm not saying there isn't a place for those stories, but there isn't a balance if you look at the whole 20 years of enough stories about the lives of black women, enough stories revealing the voices of black women, the concerns of black women, our perspectives on what's happening in the community. So that's one thing.
Is there any one particular film from the last few years that you would recommend as being, I don't know, the most important, the most authentic black film, a film that both blacks and whites should see?
Well, I guess I would go back to When the Levees Broke, the documentary that premiered on HBO this year. I compile a best of top 10 list every year for seeingblack.com, and I was just in the process of putting it together like last night actually for 2006, and there are a number of films that I really enjoyed that I really, but I would say for this year I would say When the Levees Broke.
My name is Tanya Harris, and I'm a Lower Ninth Ward resident. This is actually, it's three generations of us right here. This is my grandmother, Josephine Butler, and that's my mother, Cherry Harris. We evacuated the Sunday before the storm. My grandmother said, you know, I think this is going to be a pretty strong storm, and, you know, so I think we ought to get out of here. And my sister still wouldn't leave. But if one of us doesn't go, well, none of us will go. We all stay.
I told my guys, I went around there. I said, y'all going to leave out that house? I said, right now. I said, come on, get in the car. If you don't have anything, get in the car. Let's go. We got to go. So they got in the car. We all packed up in the car, and then we left.
It's a clip from the Spike Lee film When the Levees Broke, A Requiem in Four Acts. Esther Averam is the author of We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006. She's also the founder and editor of the cyberzine seeingblack.com. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1217B, Black Identity. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strange Shamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Thanks to engineer Megan Manning. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.